Coming up on Fronteras. On Morning Edition this week, we've heard amazing stories from NPR's Borderland series.
And obviously the border region, the borderland as we were calling it, is not at war. And yet it is that kind of region because the stories are so fascinating and so compelling. And sometimes they're joyful and heartbreaking at the same time.
Host Steve Inskeep joins us to talk more about his team's road trip along the U.S.-Mexico border and the stories about the people, goods, and culture that cross back and forth. One of the more frightening gangs that operates on the U.S.-Mexico border are the Barrio Aztecas from El Paso.
These are guys who wear body armor and know how to build car bombs and how to use an M4 or an AK-47 or some of these more high-caliber, nasty military weapons.
Monica Ortiz Uribe introduces us to the gang and its role in a brutal drug war. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. An alleged leader of a prominent gang based out of El Paso was convicted in federal court last month in the murder of two U.S. citizens. The killings happened in Ciudad Juarez, across the border in Mexico. The trial showed the inner workings of a criminal organization that profits from the international drug trade. From our Fronteras desk, Monica Ortiz Uribe has this profile of the Barrio Azteca gang.
At this billiards bar in West El Paso, men in cowboy boots guzzle Mexican beer and shoot pool to the beat of American hip-hop.
ID, por favor, señor. ID, brother.
A stocky bouncer in a polo shirt greets customers. This pool hall happens to be a hangout of the Barrio Azteca gang.
The body sticker everywhere. Many of them you'd never know. They dress well. They eat in family restaurants the same as we would.
Jeff Gibson is a detective with the El Paso County Sheriff's Department. He first encountered the gang as a rookie jailer 22 years ago. He's been on their tail ever since. The Barrio Azteca started in prison when inmates from El Paso banded together for protection.
The Barrio Azteca started in 1986 and then had a constitution and signed it. That's how formal these guys are.
The Constitution is written in both English and Spanish. These guys embody the border. Just take their name. Barrio refers to the poor Mexican-American neighborhoods where they grew up. Azteca is a nod to their pre-Hispanic roots. They live and work in both the United States and Mexico. And their main source of income?
The Barrio Azteca are integrated with the drug trafficking organizations from across the border.
This happened when Mexican drug smugglers joined up with the Barrio Aztecas in prison. The gang started working for the Juarez cartel, moving and selling its drugs. But in 2008, a rival challenged the Juarez cartel for control of its territory. A war broke out, and suddenly, the Barrio Azteca took on a more militant role.
Now these are guys who wear body armor and know how to build car bombs and how to use an M4 or an AK-47 or some of these more high-caliber, nasty military weapons.
The Barrio Azteca acquired weapons in the U.S. and smuggled them into Mexico to arm the cartel. In Juarez, they formed assassination teams whose mission was to hunt down rivals. You're listening to radio chatter between one of those assassination teams. This recording was obtained by U.S. authorities. The hit squad was responsible for the murder of an American couple driving home from a birthday party in Juarez. The wife worked for the U.S. consulate. Her husband was a jail guard in El Paso. They were chased down and shot dead in their car. In the recording, we can hear the hitmen give confirmation that the deed is done. The speaker uses coded language to say they killed a woman and a man in front of City Hall. The sole survivor of the attack was the couple's infant daughter, who was found wailing in the back seat. News of the murders reached President Obama, who denounced the crime. U.S. authorities determined the couple was targeted by mistake. In those days, the bloodshed in Juarez was so great that a day without a murder was front-page news. Today, you'll find Barrio Azteca jailed on both sides of the border. I decided to visit a prison in Chihuahua City, about 4 hours south of El Paso. Prison guards escorted me to a cell block exclusive to the gang.
So now we're going down a set of concrete steps down into a tunnel that will take us into the prison.
Once inside, I asked to speak with the Barrio Azteca. What came next was a stunning example of just how interconnected we are on the border. The guard brought out Jose Enrique Jimenez Zavala, green eyes, gray sweats, with smiley and sad faces inked onto his earlobes. His nickname is El Wicked, and he spoke perfect English.
I'm from originally from Juarez. I was raised in El Paso.
Turns out El Wicked and I grew up in the same neighborhood. We're also the same age, but that's not all.
You said you went to Bassett Middle School. That's where I went. I went to Bassett.
Yeah.
We probably were in the same school at the same time.
That's right. I drove 250 miles to come face to face with the Barrio Azteca, who'd been my middle school classmate. El Wicked's mother was a drug dealer, and his father was absent. At 18, he did time for robbery. He joined the gang in prison. Later, he ended up in Juarez, where he got into drug trafficking. Now, he's serving a life sentence for murdering 16 people at a Chihuahua bar. He's accused of killing 300 others.
There was nothing nice about my world, just parties, girls, cars, all the material things that we're always looking for. It's a real big, big price I had to pay at the end. For me, I'm looking to spend the rest of my life here.
The United States spends an estimated $18 billion on border enforcement trying to keep out illicit traffic. Still, the Barrio Azteca gang is one example of how crime manages to transcend borders. In El Paso, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep and an NPR news team recently traveled east to west along the U.S.-Mexico border. In the Borderland series, the team brought us stories about the people, goods, and culture that cross back and forth. They rented a car, hopped in, and zigzagged across the frontier. I spoke with Inskeep this week about his experience. Steve, you started your journey in Texas, and we heard you get a history lesson from the Alamo right here in San Antonio, a history all too familiar to us Texans. How do you think this history with Mexico does or doesn't play into current immigration debates?
Oh, it's huge, and it feels very present. And first, I'm glad to hear that it's very familiar to people in Texas, but I actually wondered it might depend on which part of history or which version of history you hear. We spoke with Frank de la Teja, who's a former state historian of Texas, and I think very even-handed and very complete in his treatment of things. If there was any detail that was left out, it was because our story could not be long enough to include it all, not because he didn't say it. But there are different versions of the Alamo, of the Texas Revolution, of how it happened, of what it meant. And Frank's version was very compelling, and he pointed out that there was a central role in this revolution of illegal immigration. People moved, that's a provocative thing to call it, but people moved without the Mexican government's permission into Texas. Some had permission, some did not. And that led to a chain of events that ended with the independence of Texas and further on the effective capture of what is now the American Southwest. And so you have the question of immigration, of identity, of nationality, of law, of legality and illegality, of migration being part of the story from the very beginning as we understand it and continuing to be a huge part of the story today.
You heard about the risks and the extremes that people go through to make the journey to the United States. And I think it was this morning I heard you say, you always felt like you were about to hear another unbelievable story. What surprised you the most from the people you talked to?
Oh, my gosh. First, it was to understand that. I've been in some war zones reporting for NPR. I've been in Pakistan. I've been in Iraq. I've been in Syria. And these are places where everybody you meet, you just talk about their basic daily life, and it's jaw-dropping. And obviously, the border region, the borderland, as we were calling it, is not at war. And yet it is that kind of region because the stories are so fascinating and so compelling. And sometimes they're joyful and heartbreaking at the same time. I had heard, for example, that there were non-Mexicans, non-Latin Americans who somehow got to Mexico and then crossed the border into the United States. I didn't know how that worked until we visited a shelter in San Benito, Texas, where we spoke with a number of men and women who had come from Ethiopia and Somalia and other places to Mexico and then walked across the border into the United States seeking asylum. And they revealed that there is an entire network of what some of them called connection men all through the world that can get you from Ethiopia to Sudan to Brazil and up through Latin America to Mexico, where you can make that land journey. You can't just, without a visa, fly into JFK Airport and arrive there and say you want asylum. You've got to find some other way to do it. And it's amazing the lengths that people go to.
Right. The border fence, that's something we hear a lot on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. It's in the news quite a bit, but you got a different perspective. You were up close. You touched it. You were in no man's land. What did you find there?
Oh, I appreciate you saying that, and that was our goal, certainly. You begin this story, and it's like looking at the ocean. It's like looking at the Gulf of Mexico on a quiet day. It's flat. There's nothing out there, and you think you know it all. And then you get a little below the surface, and you discover the incredible complexity of it, just like diving into the ocean. And it was my instinct that this was true, and I think reality has proven it out, that although we on the national level hear and say a lot about immigration, illegal immigration, undocumented immigrants, crime, narcotics, cross-border trade, NAFTA, even though we talk about these things, we talk about them a lot in generalities or in terms of ideology or what our ideology tells us we should think about one of these issues. But then when you go and you meet the individuals, it's amazing how complex their stories are. And you meet a guy like Dob Cunningham, a guy we interviewed who's a former Border Patrol agent. He's now retired. He's 79. He's got a ranch on the river. And he has rounded up people who cross the border illegally and turned them in. He's virtually a vigilante. He feels he's defending his land. And yet at the same time, he has immense sympathy for the people crossing, understands that most of them are just poor people who want a job. And it even turns out he has crossed the border without authorization himself to visit friends on the Mexican side. So little is black and white in this border region.
That's so true. You know, I grew up in Corpus Christi in South Texas, and, you know, there's a lot of reference to Tejano and Tex-Mex, but hearing you go across the border into other states, it seems that that sense of cross-cultural identity holds true across the Southwest border.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, we broadcast from Columbus, New Mexico, and Palomas, Mexico, where there was an elementary school, as you may have heard. And if you live in a border community, this is a normal story, what I'm about to say, but it's eye-popping for people in other parts of the country. You have an elementary school in the United States where most of the students live in Mexico. They are U.S. citizens, we're told. They're entitled to an education. It's been decided that even though they live outside the school district, indeed outside the country, that it's okay for them to go to an American school. They're Americans. And they have this bus system. There's their buses that will pick them up at the border crossing in the morning and take them across to the elementary school and then pick them up at the school in the afternoon and take them back down to the border crossing, drop them off, and all these little kids walk across the border crossing. Now, for many people, at least on the American side, the whole notion of walking across the border into Mexico is a scary thing. And here's second graders doing it, third graders doing it, and they just go across and their parents are waiting for them on the other side.
You know, you spoke to the lead singer of the famous cross-border band Intocable, and they recently played in Juarez in a place known for its violence. And tell me what they told you about that decision to go south.
Oh, I loved this story. I loved meeting Ricky Munoz, who's the lead singer of Intocable, and getting deeper and deeper into their music. He's from Zapata, Texas. Other members of the group are. I think there's other members from other parts of the world. But they had not played Juarez in 7 years, even though they've played just everywhere else in Latin America and a lot of places in the United States. They've played on both sides of the border. But the immediate border region on the Mexican side was just too dangerous for them. And it wasn't even their decision, he said. He said they weren't even doing events for a while in Juarez. And years went by, and they just couldn't go. They weren't going to do it. But things have improved in Juarez, and I'm not sure that this is fully perceived everywhere. Nor do I want to minimize the continuing crime in Juarez. We reported on continuing crime in Juarez, and the murder rate in Juarez is still pretty high. But there were more than 3,000 murders in Juarez in 2010, and now it's below 500. Just a terrible, terrible murder rate, but a vast improvement from before. And it's possible now to go to Juarez, as people did, and go to a concert, as people did, and stay there waiting on the band to start performing at 12:40, 12:41 in the morning.
You know, it was fun to follow you guys and your travels on social media, on Twitter and Tumblr, and the pictures were amazing. What were the responses that y'all got from people? And did y'all get stopped by Border Patrol on many occasions, it looked like?
Oh, thank you for your kind words about the pictures. We took a photographer along, Kai Nazamaria. People don't always realize that although we're a radio network, we do pictures because we have digital platforms, and our photographers have just won tons of awards. They're amazing people, and Kainaz was great and took a lot of the photos you've seen on the Tumblr feed or on our website as we've gone along. That was a great experience, and it's a very photogenic region, to be honest with you. It's such an easy place to take good photographs. Even I was able to take some. That was fun. Now, the Border Patrol, they've mostly been polite. They've been totally fine. There were a couple of times that we were stopped, and I think that it's appropriate that we experienced that as journalists because it's an ordinary part of life. There was a point in which a producer had gone away from us for a while and was being driven back to catch up with us, and one car was sent out to meet her in New Mexico, and she was in another car coming from El Paso, Texas, on a desolate road, Highway 9 in New Mexico, right by the border crossing, and one person hopped out of one car and got into the other car right there by the border fence. Now, what they did was perfectly legal. It was somebody getting a ride from the airport into Columbus, New Mexico, but in the dark, one person got out of a vehicle and into another vehicle, and then the vehicle turned around and went the other way. And, of course, that area is being watched. The Border Patrol is right there out in the darkness somewhere, and my colleagues were stopped by several vehicles and had to answer some questions. And it immediately became apparent that the Border Patrol had run the license plate number and knew everywhere that that vehicle had crossed the border in recent days. And you discover in a moment like that how intensely surveilled things are. Now, I want to be clear. The Border Patrol was very polite almost everywhere that we dealt with them, and they didn't treat us any differently than they treated anybody else, and I'm not even complaining about it, but it's a reality of life in the borderland that you're being watched a lot of the time.
Heading back to NPR studios and this long road trip you took and being immersed in the borderland, what will you take away from this experience and maybe how it will inform your reporting in the future?
Well, I came into this experience having read a book which divided the United States into a bunch of what the author called nations, cultural zones that have a lot in common. The Deep South is an obvious one. There were a bunch of others across the country, and he had one that he called El Norte, which is north and south of the U.S.-Mexico border, both sides of the border. And he proposed that as a contiguous region with a lot of cultural ties and trade ties, even though they're on different sides of the border in different countries. He argued that the borderland, the two sides of the border, had more in common with each other than with the country on either side. And having driven the 1,900-mile length of it, actually our trip was more than 2,400 miles the way we traveled, I think there's a lot of truth to that. It is a place where people have this immense common experience, and the common experience is the border itself. And whether you're north of it or south of it, you have that experience. It's different north or south, but people cross back and forth, and so they experience different things on both sides. This is a place where you have two immense nations that meet each other, that share ideas, that also rub up against each other and conflict and have arguments and disagreements. And it's out of that friction that I think both countries are building their future. Mexico is a huge part of the future of the United States. The United States is a huge part of the future of Mexico. And you see that future being built in the borderland.
Steve, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It was an honor to do it.
You can check out the entire Borderland series at NPR.org. There's still more Fronteras coming up. Lent is a time of spiritual reflection. It also means a change in diet for those who take part.
Most people I know don't care for nopalitos, but it's one of the dishes that makes me say an extra prayer for my soul during Lent because I love it to the point of gluttony.
Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides on how the foods of Lent can be sinfully good. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. We are in the season of Lent, a time of spiritual preparation before Easter that begins on Ash Wednesday and lasts for 40 days. And as Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides tells us, Lent means a change in the menu that could be seen as sinfully good.
Fasting, moderation, spiritual discipline, and repentance. That's how we mark the Christian season of Lent. Lent also involves giving up something difficult to forswear. So I can't help but feel guilty every year for secretly feeling happy that Lent is coming because it gives me a reason to eat some of my favorite foods, comida de cuaresma, Mexican Lenten food. During Lent, devoted folks don't eat meat on Fridays, and attention goes to dishes they might not otherwise consider for their home menus, or restaurant menus for that matter. Sometimes people just focus on eating fish instead of the many meatless Quaresma dishes found in Mexican cuisine. But there's a very particular Lenten food menu, and I strive to duplicate the recipes my mother cooked for me when I was a kid growing up in Laredo, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. My mother's a particularly wonderful Lenten food chef. The Friday dinner for us during Lent was nopalitos, made from cactus paddle, cubed, boiled, and then sautéed with onion, tomato, peppers, garlic, cilantro, and salsa de chile de árbol. In my mom's version, she adds those little tiny dried shrimp, and it all gets cooked with egg yolks folded into egg whites beaten to fluffy softness. The mosaic of colors, textures, and flavors is unmatched by any other dish I've ever had. Most people I know don't care for nopalitos, but it's one of the dishes that makes me say an extra prayer for my soul during Lent because I love it to the point of gluttony. Mom used to make tortitas, the tuna fish, for our lunch on those Lenten Fridays. This was tuna with maybe a little diced celery. With her hand mixer, she whipped up a couple eggs until they peaked and were heavenly cloud white. She folded the tuna into the eggs and spooned out the mixture into a skillet of hot oil. Out came the little croquette-like patties that she served up with arroz, with those little dried shrimp, and frijoles. Some people use other fish for these tortitas, but with our large family, tuna was the way to go. Everyone got two patties each. All these years later, right around Ash Wednesday, my guilt eats at me because I know that I would have blackmailed and bribed my siblings on some trumped-up kiddie transgression for their coveted ration. The fasting food fetish isn't anything new. In the Middle Ages, German monks lived on beer during Lent because liquids were not considered food. They'd sent some to the Pope for his approval. Over the course of the journey, the suds soured and tasted so bad, he approved the Lenten libation as suitable, sobering, figurative flagellation. Similarly, Pope Pius V didn't care for sweets and encouraged eating chocolate during Lent in the mid-1500s. Yes, chocolate. My own personal road to perdition would be paved with another confection, capirotada, perhaps my favorite comida de Cuaresma. There are variations on the theme, of course, but in the main, capirotada is a Mexican bread pudding made with day-old bolillo rolls, raisins, pecans, and cubed cheddar cheese, piloncillo, cinnamon sticks, and clove. Right out of the oven, it's sublime, but the stuff is impossibly good cold, too. And how I came upon this delicious fact is for my confessor's ears only. During Lent, we talk about what we might give up for 40 days to show our sacrifice during this special time of religious reflection. For some people, the Lenten menu is part of that sacrifice. For me, it's the guiltiest of pleasures. I wonder if I should give up Lenten food for Lent.
That was regular Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.